This is probably a silly way to begin a semi-serious lecture series, but I want to share a cartoon with you. It's because I'm conscious that this is Friday night and that sensible people don't have lectures on Friday night. The cartoon is of an elderly sister in her nightgown and cane speaking to a rather serious-faced nurse's aide standing with her arms folded. And the sister is saying to the nurse's aide, standing by her bed actually, "Honey, I've been through two world wars. The Great Depression taught 3,279 children, administered four primary schools, and outlived every one of the pastors I worked with. I'm 89 years old, and you're telling me it's bedtime?" Something about the spunk of that sister in that cartoon that I think is really appropriate for our reflection on Catherine Macaulay. My title tonight is The Biography of Catherine Macaulay: Have We Really Plumbed Its Depths? Mary Clare Moore, one of Catherine Macaulay's first companions, once wrote to her sister about Catherine Macaulay. She said of her, "Though you know much about her, you did not know her as I knew her." I think we can all say that we know the broad outline of Catherine Macaulay's life, but have we plumbed its depths? We know the overall shape of her life story, but do we know the texture of her daily goodness? We recognize her portrait on the wall, but do we know the mind and heart behind the black and white habit? The surface outline of Catherine's life can be stated in a few short paragraphs. And at the risk of repeating what some of you may already know, perhaps all of you already know, let me quickly review the bare outline of Catherine's life. She was born in Dublin in 1778, and I should also say we have a chronology for you, so don't be desperately trying to take notes. You'll have all of this later. She was born in Dublin in 1778 of James and Eleanor Macaulay. Her father died in 1783, leaving her mother and her two brothers and sisters, Catherine, Mary, and James. He left them relatively secure because of his real estate holdings. However, by 1798, the year of Eleanor Conway Macaulay's death, the family had reached what you would have to call poverty, partly because of sale of real estate properties and partly because of what Clare Moore discreetly calls pecuniary losses, by which I think she simply means unwise spending. Catherine's sister, Mary, died in August 1827, and Mary's husband, William Macaulay, and I'll explain the various Macaulay spellings at another time, Mary's husband, William, died in January 1829, leaving their five children in the care of Catherine, whom they had chosen as their legal guardian. That meant that by 1829, Catherine Macaulay was the guardian, the adoptive mother of nine children, five belonging to her sister Mary, her two cousins, Catherine and Teresa Byrne, and two orphans whom she had taken into her home earlier. From 1798 on, Catherine lived first with her uncle, Owen Conway, and then with relatives, the William Armstrongs, and finally, from 1803 on, with Catherine and William Callahan, a wealthy, elderly Protestant couple at their 22-acre estate in Coolock, a village northeast of Dublin. Catherine was household manager, a high-class servant, and companion to Catherine Callahan. Catherine Callahan died in 1819, and when William Callahan died in 1822, they left Catherine as the sole residuary legatee of their estate, which meant she was the recipient of a considerable inheritance. She continued to live at Coolock until she sold the property in September 1828, having used a sizable portion of her inheritance to build a large house that she called a House of Mercy on Bagot Street in southeast Dublin. The house opened on September 24th, 1827, was intended to provide a school for poor girls, an overnight shelter for homeless servant girls and homeless women and girls, and a residence for lay women who wished to participate with Catherine in these and other works of mercy. However, the atypical character of the community that gathered on Bagot Street, and they numbered 12 lay women by July 1830, aroused intense lay and clerical criticism. Catherine was called an upstart, a parvenu, an interferer in the ministry of the clergy. This criticism came in part because the women in the community at Bagot Street were not a religious congregation with a recognizable religious status and rule, and in part because support of the works of mercy on Bagot Street seemed in the eyes of some to compete with support of the Irish Sisters of Charity founded in Dublin in 1815. This was not the view of the Irish Sisters of Charity themselves, but only of their lay and clerical supporters. The criticism threatened to discourage young lay women from joining in the works of mercy at Bagot Street, and by threatening that, threatened the very stability of the works of mercy in which Catherine was engaged and which she hoped to see continue for some time. And so, contrary to her original intentions, she and her colleagues at Bagot Street made the decision in 1830 to found an unenclosed religious congregation devoted to the service of the poor, the sick, and the ignorant. And that phrase, the service of the poor, the sick, and the ignorant, eventually became part of the profession of vows of Sisters of Mercy. On September 8, 1830, Catherine and two companions, Anna Maria Doyle and Elizabeth Harley, entered the Presentation Convent on George's Hill, Dublin, for the purpose of beginning a novitiate prior to professing their religious vows as the First Sisters of Mercy, which they did on December 12, 1831. It's probably important for all of us to remember that Catherine later told Claire Moore, that it was so hard a struggle for her to remain at the Presentation Convent on that first night on account of meeting there many things repugnant to her feelings, that had she not had the establishment of the Sisters of Mercy most deeply at heart, she would that very evening have sent for a coach to take her back to Bagot Street. Had she sent for that coach, we would not be assembled here tonight. In the ensuing decade, prior to Catherine's death on November 11, 1841, the community on Bagot Street grew to the point where, despite increasing financial difficulties and despite many deaths among the members of that community, they chose to found branch houses in Kingston and Booterstown and seven new foundations of Sisters of Mercy in Ireland and two in England. Moreover, in 1835, Roman authorities approved the status of the Sisters of Mercy as a religious congregation, and in 1841, the year of Catherine's death, Pope Gregory XVI approved the rule and constitutions of the Sisters of Mercy. But to know in greater detail the exquisite goodness of Catherine Macaulay, the encouraging, inspiring, challenging example of her human life, one has to study three critical primary sources: the long biographical manuscripts written about her by her first companions, her contemporaries at Bagot Street, her letters and the letters written to her and about her in her lifetime, and her most important other writings, particularly the original rule and constitutions of the Sisters of Mercy, and the Spirit of the Institute essay, which will also be provided to you. In the course of these days, as we try together to examine Catherine's life in greater depth, and especially as we yearn to be moved to conversion by the inspiring example of her life, I will be drawing on all these primary sources, but especially on her correspondence, a new edition of which I have just completed. But first, let me confront a fundamental question. Why is it important, even necessary, for Sisters of Mercy and their colleagues and partners in mercy to know the woman behind the black and white portrait? Why is it important to get to know her life in some detail? After all, she lived a very long time ago in a world seemingly far different from our own, and she has been dead for over 160 years. So how can it be relevant or even beneficial to us to get to know her better? My answer to this question is my conviction, born of faith in the meaning of the gospel, that Catherine Macaulay was a gift of God to the women and men of her day, and that by the continuing generosity and providence of God, she and her story remain a strong gift, a vibrant gift to the women and men of our day. That is what a saint is. That is what a prophet is. For the history of mercy spirituality is not a museum or an art gallery. The charism of mercifulness that was given to and revealed in the life of Catherine Macaulay is not something to be kept in an old nun's archive, stored in acid-free paper, safe from tarnish and alteration. The gift of mercifulness, as revealed in the life of Catherine Macaulay, is a sacrament. A sacrament where we can encounter the presence of God in the life example of Catherine Macaulay. A sacrament of renewal, inspiration, and transformation. A place where we can converse with Catherine and with Christ in her presence. In this encounter, God does not wish us, nor does Catherine wish us, to imitate her life point for point. But neither does she wish us to be untouched by our knowledge of her and of what she tried to be and do, or unaltered by our conversation with her. She does not wish to be, nor does the God who enkindled her life wish her to be simply a portrait on the wall. In her marvelous book on the communion of saints, titled Friends of God and Prophets, Elizabeth Johnson discusses paradigmatic figures, that is, particular historical persons who focus the energies of the Spirit of God for a local community in its own unique circumstances, and so become publicly significant for the life of others. I will be arguing tonight that Catherine Macaulay has become publicly significant for our lives. We encounter the narrative memory of such a person, and something happens to us. We recognize the light of divine goodness in this vivid, real, concrete life in a way that is compellingly attractive. Johnson claims that just as the charism of a particular saint is a gift of God, so too is noticing the saint the fruit of the Spirit's moving in the community. She assures us that unique friends of God and prophets emerge in the dynamic context of ongoing history, fraught with suffering and disaster, and filled, as we well know, with temptations to infidelity to the core vocation of holiness. Johnson says, paradigmatic saints then correct or enlarge the community's moral vision, challenging the hardening of heart and the loss of creative response. Such saints, she says, may certainly be ignored, or even worse, domesticated. But if people participate in recognizing saintly character, as we will try to do this weekend, they are thereby opening themselves to a new working of grace. Thus, you have had fair warning. The Catherine McCauley we will meet this weekend will inevitably call each one of us to some conversion, some change in the way we live. And she will do so by the example of her own life. So now is your chance to leave. Now is your chance to make for the door quietly if you want to avoid the call to transformation of your life, whether you are a sister or a colleague or a friend in mercy. By and large, Sisters of Mercy have not ignored Catherine McCauley, to use Elizabeth Johnson's word, certainly not in the last 40 years since the Second Vatican Council urged us to return to the original inspiration of our founder. But we may be suffering from hardening of heart and loss of creative response because we may have domesticated her. We have put Catherine McCauley on stationery, posters, tea bags, coffee mugs of all things, and even bars of chocolate. Yes, I swear. I've saved it. I could never bring myself to eat it. We think of Catherine when we drink tea, and we may regard her simply as a comfortable companion, but not also as a prophetic revelation of the true meaning of the gospel, a revelation and a call particularly addressed to her daughters, but also to her adopted sons and daughters. One way to name what the years of her life involved for Catherine McCauley is the word self-sacrifice. Not a very common word in contemporary talk about spirituality. Perhaps because its relation to the truest fulfillment of our deepest selves is not recognized. Yet for Catherine McCauley, the reality signified by the word self-sacrifice had consuming meaning related to the kenosis, the self-emptying of Jesus. For her, self-sacrifice, the laying down of her life, was the sine qua non, that without which the inherent necessity of genuine, lifelong self-donation to the works of mercy, that without which her own commitment to the actual work of mercy would be spasmodic and incomplete. I want to focus tonight, briefly in each case, on four convictions that guided Catherine's life. Her insistence on the central importance of good example, arising from her belief that we are called to bear some resemblance to the example of Jesus. Her conviction that Christ is truly present in and identified with those who suffer. Her steadfast confidence in the providential guidance and mercy of God, and her belief that cheerfulness is the visible sign of a grateful heart, confident in God's care. It is easy enough to state these convictions. To let them actually shape and direct one's daily life is a far more difficult thing. One of Catherine's most insightful writings is her Spirit of the Institute essay. This essay is not a completely original composition, but rather her much abbreviated and slightly altered transcription of a treatise on the end and object of the Society of Jesus, written by Alonso Rodriguez. I knew I'd hear that groan. Written by Alonso Rodriguez and found in volume 3 of his Practice of Christian and Religious Perfection, first published in Spain in 1609. Now, for the benefit of those who are not Sisters of Mercy, you need to know that Sisters of Mercy of a certain age, which shall not be specified, recall from their youth reading in the novitiate Alonso Rodriguez's Practice of Christian and Religious Perfection. However, I think that the selections that we were assigned to read seem to have been the worst parts of the book. I've come to have greater appreciation for a certain wisdom in Rodriguez, if you can get below some of the language. At least Catherine McCauley, in reading Rodriguez's treatise on the Society of Jesus, on its purpose, found there something that resonated with her. And so she copied those parts of his essay that she felt were meaningful for the Sisters of Mercy. In the essay, her essay, she emphasizes two fundamental principles. We'll examine one of them tomorrow. The other is the power and centrality to the Christian life of good example. And in the first instance, of the good example of Jesus. Toward the end of the essay, Catherine says, and here I quote, "The first means which the saints have recommended to render us most useful to others is to give good example and to live in sanctity." She goes on, "Saint Ignatius says, the good example which we give by leading a most holy and Christian life has the greatest power over the minds of others. It was for this reason that our blessed Savior marked the way to heaven by his example. Jesus Christ, says St. Luke, began to do and to teach, thus signifying to us that we should do first what we would induce others to do. It is an established opinion that the way to virtue and to piety is shorter by example than by precept." A simple contemporary translation of what Catherine's saying is, if you're trying to teach the students in the school to be kind and merciful, the most important lesson you can give is your own kindness and your own mercifulness. Catherine's belief in the necessity of giving good example was borne out in her own words and actions in her silences and sufferings. And this conviction was intimately related to her desire to bear some resemblance to the example of Jesus Christ. This humble and theologically astute phrase, bear some resemblance, her way of speaking about the following of Christ, appears in her letters and in several of her early biographical accounts written about her. For example, writing on Easter Monday in 1841 to Elizabeth Moore in Limerick, Catherine says, "I am impatient to send you a few hurried lines, humbly beseeching God to impart to us all some portion of those precious gifts and graces which our dear Redeemer has purchased by his bitter sufferings, that we may endeavor to prove our love and gratitude by bearing some resemblance to him, copying some of the lessons he has given us during his mortal life, particularly those of his passion." In the first edition of the Practical Sayings of Catherine Macaulay, published in London in 1868, Claire Moore records the following instructions of Catherine. And I quote, she says, Catherine said the following, "The study of a religious should be the life and maxims of Jesus Christ. This divine model should be like a book continually open before her, from which she is to learn what she is to think, say, and do. And this maxim should be engraved on her heart, that although she possessed a knowledge of all the sciences and was distinguished for sense, prudence, and elegance, so as to gain the admiration of everyone, yet if she has not studied Jesus Christ and formed her mind on his example, she wants all in wanting the science of the saints." And she goes on, "We find those who can enumerate very particularly all that Jesus Christ said and did. He said and did so, not that we should recount it in words, but show him in our lives, in our daily practice. Thus only can we realize what he designed in our regard." Catherine Macaulay's central goal in life was focused on Jesus Christ, that she might be fashioned on his example, that she might bear some resemblance to him. She wished to assume ever more and more the virtues and aims of Jesus. At the heart of her desire to resemble Jesus was a very specific scriptural passage. Jesus' explicit self-identification with those who suffer, as presented in Matthew's account of the final reign of God. Jesus' claim that just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me. It was truly Catherine Macaulay's belief, deepened and strengthened over time, that the poor, the hungry, the thirsty, the homeless, the naked, the dying, the sick, were real living presences of Jesus Christ, afflicted in all these corporal ways with their related spiritual miseries. It is easy enough to say that this is one's belief. It is quite another thing to so design and live one's life that this belief is enfleshed in one's action day in and day out. In her rule, in chapter 3 on the visitation of the sick, Catherine writes, "Mercy, the principal path pointed out by Jesus Christ to those who are desirous of following him, has in all ages of the church excited the faithful in a particular manner to instruct and comfort the sick and dying poor, as in them they regarded the person of our divine master, who has said, 'Amen, I say to you, as long as you did it to one of these, my least brethren, you did it to me.'" Later, in the same chapter, on the visitation of the sick, Catherine speaks of the recollection the sisters should have as they approach the dwellings of those who are poor, the bare floor hovels on Townsend Street and Bull Alley. She says, "Two sisters shall always go out together, preserving recollection of mind and going forward as if they expected to meet their divine Redeemer in each poor habitation, since he has said, 'Where two, etc., are in my name, I will be.'" The reverence of that approach is for me truly moving. The veneration and homage that is required when one enters the presence and sacred space of those who suffer, of those in whom Christ suffers. Whether one remembers little Mary Quinn, who sat beside Catherine, an orphan child, at the Bagot Street table, or Mary Ann Redman, a stranger to Catherine, who had her leg amputated at Bagot Street, or the young girl who ran away from Killarney and rang the Bagot Street doorbell late at night, or the poor girls loitering about the roads in Kingston for whom Catherine built a school. Whoever it is that we remember in Catherine's daily life, we realize that something far different from her own convenience or her own security or her own comfort moved the constant merciful hospitality of her heart. It was the vivid, pleading presence of Jesus Christ, whom she saw and heard in those who suffer. I'd like to turn now to the third overarching conviction that guided Catherine McAuley's life, one with which we may be so familiar that we may have lost awareness of what it meant in her daily life. I speak of Catherine's confidence in the unfailing providence of God, her belief that God's care is greater than the sufferings and other problems that befall us, and that in the end, God will establish God's reign. I'd like to begin this reflection by reading an excerpt from a letter of Reverend Edward Armstrong to Archbishop Daniel Murray, the Archbishop of Dublin, written on March 15, 1828, 2 months before Armstrong died. As many of you know, Father Armstrong was Catherine Macaulay's beloved personal friend and her spiritual director in the 1820s. It was he who helped her choose the site on Bagot Street for the House of Mercy. He told her, "If you would have a public institution be of service to the poor, place it in the neighborhood of the rich." Edward Armstrong was dying in March 1828 when he wrote this letter asking Daniel Murray to be executor of his will and to distribute whatever few material things he might leave. But what is most striking about his letter is his concern for Catherine Macaulay and for her future support. The whole letter is a very beautiful letter in that regard, but I'll only read the last paragraph. He writes, "The only great solicitude which presses on me is with respect to Miss Macaulay. When I shall be taken from her, she will find herself bereft to a great measure of an ecclesiastical friend, which is a desideratum for her of the utmost importance. Surrounded on every side by prejudiced relatives and acquaintances, she will be much straitened to follow up her good purposes unless protected and supported by some zealous and religious friend. Could I pledge myself to her that you, Daniel Murray, could I pledge myself to her that you would be that good friend who would support and uphold her good purposes, there could not be any fear for her." Certainly, Daniel Murray appears to have had profound respect for Catherine Macaulay, and the Sisters of Mercy were blessed to have been founded during his long episcopacy rather than in that of his successor, Cardinal Paul Cullen, given that appropriate freedom of movement, local governance, flexibility, and a certain measure of self-regulation were essential to the congregation's early development. But as Catherine's extant correspondence reveals, she had reason to feel bereft of Daniel Murray's explicit support and expected intervention in the two controversies with diocesan priests that most afflicted her: the chaplaincy issue and the Kingston debt. In these and other trials, she finally clung most strongly to the stark injunction in Edward Armstrong's dying words to her: "Do not place your confidence in any human being, but place your confidence in God alone." All the early biographical manuscripts written by Catherine Macaulay, or Catherine Macaulay's contemporaries, speak of these words of Edward Armstrong and of their effect on Catherine's spirit. The Limerick manuscript, for example, tells us that when in the mid-1820s, Catherine saw the building on Bagot Street under construction, and when she reflected on the magnitude of the work in which she had almost imperceptibly engaged, with the expense it would necessarily entail, she began to be much troubled with apprehensions that her charitable projects could never be realized. I'm still quoting the Limerick manuscript. Dr. Armstrong supported and encouraged her in all her difficulties. He comforted her with the assurance of using all the influence he possessed to promote the good work. He was above all things solicitous that she should purify her intention and place all her confidence in God alone. To this, he repeatedly and emphatically exhorted her, saying over and over again, "Do not put your trust in any human creature. Place all your confidence in God alone." The Derry manuscript, written by Mary Ann Doyle, Catherine's first companion at Bagot Street, tells us that Catherine felt Father Armstrong's death most severely. It occurred, too, at a time when his advice and approbation would have been a great consolation to her, for many had begun to murmur at her proposed institution. Of this, he had been aware and did all in his power to promote the interests of the establishment. He wrote to His Grace, the Archbishop, as we have seen, urging every motive likely to secure his protection, and also applied to others whom he hoped would and whom he knew were able to serve her. Yet when he told her of this and of the favorable assurances he had received, he emphatically repeated again and again, "Do not put your trust in any human being, but place all your confidence in God." Catherine never forgot those words, but more importantly, she tried always to live by them. Over and over in her letters, we find her confiding in the never-ceasing kindness of our beloved Savior. She urges Elizabeth Moore and the Limerick community, when they were grieving in the sudden death from typhus of Mary Teresa Vincent Potter, she wrote to them, "Bless and love the fatherly hand which has hurt you. He will soon come with both hands filled with favors and blessings." In a letter she wrote to Elizabeth Moore on January 13, 1839, a long and wonderful letter, of which you will have a copy tomorrow, Catherine identifies the one reliable energy guiding the history of the Sisters of Mercy, the merciful providence of God. She says of the Institute, "There has been a most marked providential guidance which the want of prudence, vigilance, or judgment has not impeded. And it is here that we can most clearly see the designs of God. I could mark," she says, "circumstances calculated to defeat it at once, but nothing, however injurious, in itself has done any injury. This is all I could say." Finally, let us reflect briefly on Catherine Macaulay's cheerfulness. Arising from her belief, the cheerfulness is the sign of a grateful, humble, and zealous heart. A heart that confides unhesitatingly and gratefully in the abiding assistance of God, and eagerly desires to bear some resemblance to Jesus. In the first edition of the Practical Sayings of Catherine Macaulay, Claire Moore says that Catherine used to say, "As the most acceptable return a benefactor can receive from those on whom he bestows favors is a countenance testifying the gratitude of the heart. How acceptable must it be to God when we make him this return, showing to all by our cheerful, happy countenance the gratitude with which our hearts overflow toward him for his many favors in this life and his great promises for the life to come." And then she goes on, "It is said of our divine Redeemer that he was always pleasing to behold and never sad or troublesome." The joy of heart that we will see in Catherine Macaulay this weekend is not the giddiness of one who does not think or has never suffered, but the playful generosity of one who leans completely on the steadfast virtue of God and who does not attribute to herself the graceful goodness that sustains her. Tonight, let's restrict our gaze, and it's hard to do, but let us restrict our gaze to just one manifestation of her cheerfulness. The humorous poem letters she wrote. Catherine realized she was a hack poet. She said as much. But she wrote many, often very funny poem letters to lighten the hearts of her correspondents, to bring them laughter, to lift their burdens, to tease them. You have in your hands, I hope, a poem letter written in 1839 to Ursula Frayne. We are in one of the two cities of Ursula Frayne, Melbourne. And next week I will go to Perth. Ursula Frayne was at the time superior of the branch house in Booterstown on the Irish Sea. Evidently, Ursula had asked Catherine if she could purchase new boots for the winter weather. And she had also told Catherine that she didn't want the teacups Catherine had loaned to Booterstown from Bagot Street. This poem, humorously alleging that Ursula's sense of poverty has flitted away, is Catherine's response. "My dear sister Muse, I am sorry to find that sweet holy poverty's not to your mind. What in your case would a poor girl do but look for a cobbler to mend her old shoe? Is souling and healing a language obscure to those who have freely made vows to be poor? How many bleak winters were safely passed through with nothing to keep out the wet but a shoe? And now, when we should be abounding in fruit, we are wishing to dress up our foot in a boot. The advocates here did wisely discover that a break in the stocking, the boot would quite cover. Oh, shame for a sister of mercy to own that she'd cover up what she ought to have sown. May we not fear 'tis the enemy lurking, our fears and our fancies so artfully working, who at the word cobbler would teach us to blush and whisper, get boots made of leather and plush. But where reason is not, all reasoning is lost, then pray get the boots to keep out the frost. Now as to the china, your taste must be bad if you don't like what we send more than those that you had. They were once, I assure you, nice breakfast cups, and no mouth but your own could make them three sups. Ursula was complaining that they were too small and you could drink down the tea in three sups. And Catherine is saying, no mouth but your own could swallow that whole cup. They hold full as much as the modern grand shapes, and each cup and saucer have different landscapes. Here again, holy poverty's flitted away. 'Tis plain you want nothing in this but display. I pray you, dear child, cast these feelings away. Should good Father John, that was the parish priest in Booterstown, John Ennis, should good Father John your breakfast e'er favor, let his tea be well made and of exquisite flavor. I'll answer for him. He'll chat all the time and know no more of these cups than he does of this rhyme. You say that they are safe there as here, but 'tis far more convenient to keep them all near. She's arguing, you know, you say, well, you'll, even though you're not going to use them, you'll keep them in Booterstown. Oh, no, we want them at Bagot Street. We get desperate for a sufficient number of cups from time to time, and we'd like them here. You say that they are safe there as here, but 'tis far more convenient to keep them all near. For when we have much things in haste to prepare, it makes a great difference to be here or there. They might, without damage, make two or three trips, yet 'tis very likely they'd meet a few chips. And although they went safely day after day, they'd at length get a fall and break on the way. You remember the story, when learning to spell, of the pitcher that often was sent to the well. Though many times it in safety had passed, yet on the way it was broken at last. As I have not got a poetical name, borrowing yours, I beg to remain the affectionate mother of Ursula Frame. No great competition for John Keats and Percy Bysshe Shelley, but a loving, generous, humorous heart. The life of Catherine Macaulay, which I hope we will come to know in a deeper way this weekend, is not a life of oddities or peripheral aspects of the Christian life. Her convictions about the necessity of good example, about bearing some resemblance to him, about the presence of Christ in the poor, about the sustaining, guiding, mysterious providence of God, and about the sacramental gift of human cheerfulness, are central elements in a Christian consciousness and Christian way of life. The Sisters of Mercy might conceivably have been founded by a very holy but outwardly grim and unapproachable woman, but by the grace of God, that was not the case, and we are the better for it. Catherine Macaulay was a warmly affectionate, playful, unpretentious, struggling, ordinary woman. And as we journey with her these days, I hope you will feel her by your side, encouraging you and accompanying you in the conversion she submitted to herself and that she wishes for all of us. On the day of her death, she said to Mary Vincent Whitty, the future founder of Brisbane, but then a newly professed 22-year-old. Catherine said to her, "If you give yourself entirely to God, all you have to serve him, every power of your mind and heart, you will have a consolation you will not know where it comes from." This weekend, Catherine wishes that entire giving and that full consolation to be renewed in each of us. May her prayer be fulfilled.